So tonight will be the last installment of our series on parental guidance, suggested perspectives on Jewish parenting in an ever-changing world. I want to thank you for joining us this evening. I know that Sunday night wasn't really necessarily the optimal time for everyone, but this is how things worked out for the last lecture. Tonight, again, we're going a little bit out of order, but the way things worked out, I'm sort of satisfied with the way things came together, because stepping in and stepping aside, inspiring independence in a scary world, although originally this was listed as number 4 out of 6, in some ways I think this, you know, in my mind anyway, the way it sort of evolved is a way for us to transition this discussion in a way that we can sort of take all of the or many of the thoughts that we have been sharing over the past month or two, and really, you know, trying to bring them together in a sort of concrete way. So I'd like to begin tonight's discussion by bringing us back to Abraham Maslow. As you may recall, hopefully, in the first lecture, which was sort of an introduction to our discussion, we spoke briefly about Abraham Maslow and his famous hierarchy of needs. And the hierarchy of needs, which is found there at the bottom, but let's just get a bigger picture of it right over here. So he presents the fact that human beings have certain needs in this world, and what we tend to do is try to obtain our most important needs first, and if we are successful in doing so, so then we sort of graduate to the next level. And so we have at the bottom our physiological needs, which include food, water, warmth, and rest. As human beings, we then have needs for safety. And then there are certain psychological needs that once a person's basic physiological needs are met, so the sense of belonging and the need for love, for self-esteem, and the highest level, the one that not everyone necessarily is able to achieve in this world, but what really sort of distinguishes the human being from other species on Earth, is this idea of self-actualization, being able to achieve one's full potential, including creative activities. This, of course, is an oversimplification, a very profound idea, but one that even though it had gone under many different iterations, even in Dr. Maslow's life, since then has been studied and reviewed and argued and really implemented in many different areas of thought within psychology. So a thought occurred to me, which I introduced you back then, and it occurs to me now, again, as we sort of wrap up our discussion, that we can sort of apply this model when we think about the sort of responsibilities that parents have for children. When you think about the basic physiological needs, food, water, warmth, and rest, it is here, of course, that parents have an absolute, a very primary and obvious responsibility to be there, to provide, to give to their children. The same is true, of course, when it comes to safety needs, to making sure that our children's basic feelings of security and actual needs for security are met, a sense of belongingness and love and self-esteem. So this is all part of our obligation as parents. When we come to the highest level, however, that of self-actualization, when you think about it, that is really probably what we want most for our kids. We want our children to be able to achieve their potential. We want them to be able to feel good about themselves and to feel a constant sense of fulfillment. But it's precisely at this point, as we go sort of higher in this pyramid, that our responsibilities become more elusive. And it's not necessarily clear, you know, what in fact we can do. And whereas when it comes to food, water, warmth, and rest, and security and safety, it's very clear what we can do. It's very tangible, it's very concrete, it's very practical. And if we were failing to do so, we would be criticized of criminal neglect. When it comes to the higher level needs, so it's not clear. It's not clear how to implement it, and it's not even clear what our role is. As parents, I think we could all agree that we want our children to be the following. We want our children to be happy and content. We want our children to be fulfilled, to just feel a sense of satisfaction in life. We want our children to be safe. We want our children to be productive. We want our children to be able to do things in the world which give them a sense of accomplishment and actually contribute to the world in a meaningful way. We want our children to be independent. We don't want them to have to rely on us or on others, but we want them to be able to learn to navigate the difficult situations that they will encounter in life on their own. We want them to be socially appropriate, to know how to interact with their peers at all different stages in life, and to be able to be a source of support to their friends and to their peers, and also to, you know, to develop the appropriate awareness and social cues to be able to know how to interact appropriately with others. We want them to be responsible. We want our kids to be able to appreciate that when you take responsibility for yourself, then you can get a lot more done, and that when people rely on you, it's important that you come through for them. We want our children to be stable, to be calm, and not to live frantic lives in which we're always coming and going and running and never seem to be able to slow down. We want our kids to be religiously observant, which of course was a topic of extensive discussion in one of the earlier lectures, as was our desire that our children should be spiritually attuned and to have a sense of the spirit, the sense of God and things in the world that we can't necessarily touch and see. We want our children to be thoughtful and caring. We want our children to be generous, and we want our children to be a lot more. This is not necessarily a Maslow's list of self-actualization, but in fact, if you go and you look at his list, you'll see that many of these actually describe what a self-actualized person is, somebody who's happy and content and filled and fulfilled and productive and independent, responsible and stable, etc. This is what we want for our children. Of course, we want to be able to make sure that our children have what to eat and that they're comfortable and warm at night, but we want so much more for them. So of course, in this final lecture, we hope to be able to talk about how can we make our children happy and content, fulfilled and safe and productive, independent, responsible, stable, thoughtful, caring, generous. Can we in fact make our children any of these things? Because we want it so badly. This is what we want for our children. So can we make our children into any of these things? So what's the answer? You must be a parent. Yeah. Right. You said that with such confidence. And the answer is, you're correct. No, there is not. There is no way to make our children, and this is probably the most important and difficult lesson of parenting, that we can't make our children into all these things. Now that's, you can argue, depressing. That's a little sad. That's a little frustrating. After all, if it's true that this is really what we want most for our children, then why can't we make them into these things? And of course, you know, that's only half true, that we can't make them into these things. We can't make them, meaning, as I said last week, we have to sort of accept who our children are, and we have to accept how much control we ultimately have in terms of who they become and how they develop. At the same time, that doesn't mean that we have no role, that we play no role, and it doesn't mean that our efforts are completely a waste. No, to the contrary. Just bringing you back to where we started as well, remember when raising children, there is binyan, there's building, and there's riya. And when we talk about most of the things that are on that list, what we'll call self-actualization of parenting, so I think our focus is really on Zriya. We have to recognize that while we cannot make our children happy and content and fulfilled, there's a lot that we can do in terms of the planting of the seeds so that they will hopefully develop in that way. And therefore, what I'd like to do, you know, for the first part of tonight's time with you is go back to that list and throw out some ideas, just suggestions, and there's nothing so profound that you're going to hear from me tonight, but looking again at the different categories that we had listed, so we cannot make our children into happy, content children. How can we inspire and enable and encourage them to become happy and content? What are things that we can do which will, again, inspire them and encourage them? So one of the things we can do is we can praise them thoughtfully. What does it mean, praise them thoughtfully? So the way you praise someone thoughtfully is you put some thought into the way you praise them. There's nothing wrong with saying, you look nice today. That's a nice thing to say to anybody, certainly a child. But it's appropriate when complimenting and praising other people, particularly children, to single out certain things that make them actually look nice, or if they put something together, or if they did something. So instead of just saying, oh, that's so pretty, that's so nice, to point out why it is so, and to try to be specific as possible. And this gives a person a sense of true accomplishment. This boosts children's self-esteem, which ultimately, of course, is what will make them happy and content. We can inspire and encourage our children to become happy by teaching and modeling positive thinking. If we are grumpy all the time, if we are moody, if we are not happy and content, that doesn't necessarily mean that our children will be just like us. But it goes without saying that when we are able to model, and this is true about everything, but I think it's more so when it comes to certain things, a feeling of happiness and contentment in life, this is something that children definitely do pick up on. We should express our personal contentment and satisfaction. If we're feeling content in life, we should say it from time to time. And this doesn't mean that we have to walk around whistling 24/7. That would be a little unusual, and that's not real. It's not genuine. And there are very, very few people on earth that can actually feel such a sense of happiness at every moment that they're walking around, literally like they're skipping on the top of the world. No, it's not the way we are to be. But certainly, certain moments, I will highlight Shabbos as being one of them. Not to say that every Shabbos is going to be one for the books, but we should try to create an environment on Shabbos in which we can actually feel a sense of satisfaction and happiness that we can then express to our children. How can we inspire children to feel fulfilled? We cannot make them fulfilled, but we can inspire them, again, by modeling fulfillment, by reminding them of the blessings that they have in their life, big and small. There's nothing more powerful than taking an opportunity when reciting a bracha with a child to point out, as we've discussed in the past, some of the incredible miracles in the world around us that kids can really appreciate and get excited about sometimes a lot more than adults can. Spending quality time with children is an important way that we can help them be fulfilled. How can we inspire them to be safe? By modeling safe living. I think several weeks ago we gave an example, which is such a powerful example and an important one to remember. It's not the only one, but it's such a makas a medina in our world today, and that is texting and driving. If you have children, and, well, it goes without saying, you should never text and drive. If you have children in the car, you shouldn't text and drive, even if they're sleeping and they're not even watching you. But once they are awake, in addition to the fact that you are endangering your own life and the life of other people by texting and driving, which is already a reason you can't do it, but this is a great opportunity to model for them safe living. And of course, it's not just about texting and driving. And this, of course, is true even if your child is only 7 or 8 years old and is many, many years away from driving. And in all likelihood, by the time he or she gets his license, the cars are going to be driving by themselves anyway. But doesn't make a difference. This is an example. And there are so many, many more examples of what it means to be safe. This applies to all of our habits in life. And we should try to be healthy. We should not overreact or exaggerate danger. When we do so, so we don't really help our children understand what danger is and what safety is. If we make it sound to them as if every single electric appliance in the house is something that is very, very dangerous, and if you touch it, it could instantaneously combust and blow you up in the entire house, so then that's not really going to be helpful for your child. On the other hand, you know, there are certain appliances and there are certain things around the house that that can, in fact, be very dangerous to children. And so, therefore, we should be realistic in terms of the messages that we send to our children. Don't baby-proof everything in your house. Let your kids explore. Obviously, you have to be smart with that. But every once in a while, you see it's people who they baby-proof everything. And so there is no way possible for the kid to ever stub his toe or hit his head or do something which will hurt. And that's not really inspiring and able to encourage children to become safe, because things in life hurt. And it's best to learn it when you're young than when you're old. How can we encourage our children to become productive? So one way is to encourage your children to do things, especially things that don't involve screens. I think it's fair to say that anything that involves a screen is not considered doing for the purpose of being productive. It is true that one day your child may become a day trader and spend most of his or her day in front of computer screens, earning millions and millions of dollars. That is true. It is possible. And maybe they'll even be like a surgeon. And, you know, surgeons today are doing a lot of their work through computers. That is true. But for the most part, when it comes to really being productive, being creative, being able to use one's hands and one's mind to be able to learn how the world works, so this means being able to just do things and to practice and to experience life. Encourage them to experiment and to learn through trial and error. Allow them to fail and encourage them not to mourn failure. Sometimes adults become very, very disappointed when things don't work out the first time. When our kids see that, say they learn from us, and, you know, if failure is like the end of the world, then they will, you know, they will experience it the same way. I remember hearing years ago, I don't remember in from who and in whose name, but there was a Rebbe who once said that there are several important lessons that we can learn from children. You know, we're talking about things we can teach children, but the things we can learn from children. And one of the important messages that adults can learn from children is the way they fall, and then they get up. You know, very often you see kids, especially when they first start to walk, they take a couple steps and they fall down, they take a few more steps and they fall down. But adults don't do that. Adults, you know, when we feel that we are failing, we just give up and try something else. But kids are very resilient and they're very persistent. We need to encourage that and to tell them that it's okay to fail. Actually listened a couple of months ago to a very interesting description of a company. I don't remember the name of the company, where they actually, it's a little bizarre concept, but they actually reward their employees for failing. I'm not quite sure exactly how that works, now that I'm trying to remember it right now. But they put such a value, such a premium on failing, and to recognize when a certain project that you've been working on is really not working, that if you basically pull the plug at the right time, then that's something that you could be rewarded for, to recognize that this isn't working and to be okay and to learn from your mistakes and move on. How do we inspire children to become independent? We should give them choices. If we make all of our children's choices for them so that they can never become independent, because part of independence means I could do this or that, and I have to decide which one's the best one. Now, obviously, there's always the better choice and the worst choice. But if we don't give them choices, then they are not going to learn to become independent. They're not going to trust themselves. Don't rush to assist them. Allow them to climb at the playground and don't lift them. It's been a few years since I've had the opportunity to take any of my children to the playground. They're sort of beyond that at this point. But it wasn't all that long ago, and I can still remember, and I'm sure, you know, you remember and you can experience, you see this all the time, where parents take their children to the playground, and the kid is reaching up and very frustrated because he can't get to the top. So what do parents do? And it seems very innocent, and I'm not going to say that it's like a terrible thing for a parent to do. But this is the first thing we do as parents, is we lift our kids up so that they can reach really, really high places. But maybe that's not the purpose of a playground. Maybe the purpose of the playground is, you know, see what you can do on your own. And if you're not ready to, you know, to make it all the way to the top yet, well then, you know, wait a couple more weeks or months or years, and then sooner or later you get there. Maybe there's a reason you can't go all the way to the top, because if I put it all the way to the top, you're not going to be able to get down safely. So the idea of not always rushing to assist and to enable our children to achieve the next level is a great way to teach them independence. And don't always make yourself available. This is also something that came up in one of the previous lectures, a major, major challenge that we have today's parents, that our kids can reach us at all time and we could reach them. If a child ever calls us or texts us, there's a great temptation to respond to whatever the need is. Now, obviously, sometimes there are real emergencies, and that's one of the great benefits of technology, but not every emergency is truly an emergency. One of the things I've had to teach my kids over the years is don't use that word emergency if it's not an emergency. Like, it has to be a real, real emergency. Otherwise, it may have to wait, because, you know, otherwise, you know, you can't differentiate one from the other. But if your child is feeling something that seems to him or her to be an emergency, but it's not a life-threatening emergency or anything like that, so then let them figure it out. And ultimately, they'll become more independent. Don't bail them out. If your child is arrested, God forbid, we should discuss that offline. Maybe from time to time it's appropriate. But when we speak about bailing out in a more general sense, then, you know, not every situation is one which kids should be bailed out and deserve that benefit of having a parent who can go ahead and fix a problem that they created. And part of being independent is to suffer certain consequences and to learn next time. But if we are constantly bailing out our children, or not even constantly, but, you know, at the most important moments in life, so then we are impairing their ability to become truly independent. How can we inspire, enable, and encourage our children to become socially appropriate? So first of all, we have to model socially appropriate behavior. It goes without saying. If we want our children to learn how to be nice and pleasant and appropriate around other people, we have to do the same. If we want our kids to dress appropriately in front of our kids, other people, not to, you know, to go to other people's houses and put their feet on the furniture, you know, maybe that's a silly example, but maybe not. So then we need to, you know, just be mindful of the fact that our kids are going to watch us. We should model empathy for others. Part of one of the most important components of human connection is empathy, our ability not just to feel bad for somebody else, but to sort of connect with them where they are and feel their suffering. This is something that we can model for our children, and it could be very powerful, and that's a great way to encourage our children to become socially appropriate on a very enhanced level. Give them opportunities to practice social behaviors. Don't intervene too much, and don't try to micromanage their social relationships at all different levels, but allow them the opportunity to sort of explore and figure things out on their own. Develop a sophisticated emotional vocabulary and share with your child. You know, there's more to life than happy and sad. There are many, many other different emotions that people feel, and over time, obviously, as it's age appropriate, we should be able to understand for ourselves and then communicate to our children, you know, how people can feel so many different types of emotions, sometimes at the same time, and what that means, and what that may look like, and how we are supposed to interact with such a person when they look like this and when they're expressing something. How can we encourage our children to become responsible? Well, we said assign them with age-appropriate tasks. I don't love using the word chores. I don't know, that word was never used in my house. Nothing wrong with the word, but, you know, tasks or assignments, it all means the same thing. But we should certainly hold our kids responsible to do certain things so that they can actually become responsible. If we do everything for them, have you ever seen the following where a mother or a father is yelling at his or her child that they're always making a mess? And as they're yelling, they're cleaning up everything off the floor. Have you ever seen that? I don't know. I've seen it. That's what parents very often do. It's understandable why we would, you know, do that, but when you think about it, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. We're upset that our children are not cleaning up after themselves, and as we're expressing that, we're cleaning up after them. So the way that, you know, that our children become responsible is to hold them responsible, to praise them for taking responsibility, especially when it's something that they do on their own. These are great opportunities to really, again, boost a child's self-esteem. Generally speaking, reinforcing behavior with positive feedback is the most effective way of reinforcing any behavior. Avoid constant rewards. When we go ahead and we're constantly rewarding children for things that they do right, they're not necessarily learning to be responsible. They're just reacting or proactively doing something in order to, you know, in response to a certain anticipated stimulus. Right, we don't want our children to be like conditioned dogs. Yeah.
You're saying praise them, but don't give them too much.
Well, rewards and praise are two different things. It's absolutely. I don't think there's a.
Does that mean giving them something, or just verbally?
Just verbal praise. I mean, that's what I have in mind. So praising children, obviously, if you're gonna, even you can in theory praise someone too much, which just doesn't seem genuine. But I'm not an expert when it comes to anything I'm talking about right now. But in my mind, there's a difference between praise. Verbal praise and giving rewards, like stickers or points or money or anything like that. Sometimes it's appropriate. You know, kids, especially kids who are struggling to achieve certain goals, sometimes, and that's actually not something we really spent any time talking about in any of these lectures, but it's an interesting discussion for another time about when it's appropriate to actually reward children. But if we're trying to encourage them to become responsible, sometimes it's necessary in order to get something going and to sort of catalyze. If there's something that, you know, that requires some some energizing, but just to, you know, constantly be handing out whatever the reward may be in response to showing responsibility, that's not a good way to become responsible. Allow your children to feel the consequences of not taking responsibility. If they were supposed to get something done and they didn't, so that's a great opportunity for them to see what happens. Right? You know, you can make choices in life, you cannot choose your consequences. And when we shield our children of consequences, so we're not helping them become responsible, take a step back, which is, of course, related to many of the other things. How can we encourage our children to be stable? So stay calm, cool, and collected, right? As if that's so easy. If we demonstrate to our children that we are calm, to the extent that we can be, and cool and collected, and don't, you know, go nuts over small things, so then they will absolutely, absolutely learn from that. And again, a lot of this is temperament, and a lot of this is just personality, and there are certain people, parents and children, who are going to find it easier to be calm and cool and collected. But it is absolutely true, and it's, I think it's an undeniable fact, that when kids are exposed to parents who cannot control themselves, it is actually, you know, going, you know, that being raised in such an environment is modeling some very, very poor behaviors with the kids, which that will definitely pick up on. If we can follow routines and schedules, we don't have to be, you know, rigid. It's important to be flexible. That's part of being calm and cool and collected. But if we can be you know, we can have a schedule and have certain routines that the kids can expect if we get prepared and be on time and model restraint and self-soothing. So these are all the sorts of behaviors that kids can ultimately learn and then become stable themselves. We can inspire children to be religiously observant by modeling religious observance. That should be obvious. By modeling commitment and sacrifice, which is, I mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned in a parenting lecture, but we mentioned in one of the talks that we had on Friday night a couple months ago, that in our, it's, you know, it's a discussion for another time, but I think that this is one of the challenges maybe of the modern Orthodox community in particular, that we do sacrifice a lot. You know, there are major, major sacrifices that we make in order to be able to have what we try to have as modern Orthodox Jews. But our kids don't always see that commitment and that sacrifice. And I think that our kids very often, they don't see enough of it. And part of what it means to be a religiously observant person means that from time to time I have to say, no, I can't have this. Or I have to do something they don't necessarily want to do. Of course, religious observance is not supposed to feel like pain and suffering at all time, but commitment and sacrifice is an important component of what it means to be an Eved. Not a slave, but a servant of Hashem. And if our children don't see this, they're not going to necessarily develop as easily into a truly religiously observant person. Don't complain too much about religious observance. I don't think it's ever appropriate to complain, but if you do from time to time, it's not the end of the world. But it shouldn't be part of our general experience that we're complaining and kvetching about, you know, what we need to do in order to meet our religious obligations. Create positive moments around religious observance. This is something that, while it's not directly going to be about religious observance, if we can create a positive context in which we are expressing our religious observance, that this is just, again, something that's going to be enriching for children, and they're going to want more and more of it, because in general, we are attracted to things that make us feel good. We can encourage our children to become spiritually attuned. This I just lifted for one of the previous lectures that we spoke an entire hour about this. Encourage and welcome questions. Don't pretend to have all the answers. Teach spirituality in everyday moments. Instill an appreciation of nature and tell stories. These are a whole bunch of things that we've discussed in the past that we can do in order to encourage our children to become spiritually attuned. We can inspire, enable, and encourage them to become thoughtful and caring by modeling thoughtfulness, by writing letters and notes, which is not the kind of thing you see people do too often. But every once in a while, I do receive a note from somebody, and it's very nice and very thoughtful. I don't know how often people who do that do it in front of their children, but that's a very, very thoughtful and caring thing that I think would make an impact on a child today to see, what are you doing? What is that thing in your hand? It's a pen? What's a pen? And to see, you know, it's a little different. When we take the time to actually pen a note to somebody, that is a sign of great thoughtfulness. We should outlaw name-calling, and we should not trash-talk any other people, because when we do so, we are not displaying thoughtfulness and caring about other people. So we should be pretty machbid. You know, everybody has their own rules in their house and what's okay and what's not okay. Or we should all, like I said, in general, be flexible, but it's okay to have rules. We don't do this in our house, and I think that this is a good rule to have. You know, we don't talk that way about people. So if something's bothering you, you know, keep it to yourself, or let's come up with another way to talk about it. I'm going to now take a couple of paragraphs from a book that I've referred to more than once, Wendy Mogul. If you haven't figured out yet, I'm a big fan of her books. The first is The Blessing of a Skinned Knee. The second is The Blessing of a B Minus. I highly recommend it. If you don't own a copy and you buy one, I don't think you'll regret it. You'll probably see that her fingerprints are all over pretty much every lecture that I gave. So this is one of my favorite paragraphs from her book. Now, she, I believe I'm mistaken, she is Jewish. She's a psychologist who practices and obviously writes books out in the West Coast. Her book is not a Torah book per se, but she tries to infuse a lot of Torah thoughts into her writings, which is nice. I mean, it's not, you know, that's not what I like about it, but it you know, it makes the whole thing that much more batam. So why not? So she writes over there, Talmud sums up the Jewish perspective on child rearing in a single sentence. A father is obligated to teach a son how to swim. And this is interesting, because I don't think we made this point in any one of the previous lectures, and it's very appropriate for tonight's discussion. That Chazal tell us that a father has to teach a son how to swim. Why swimming? So Jewish wisdom holds that our children don't belong to us. They are both a loan and a gift from God, And the gift has strings attached. Our job is to raise our children to leave us. The children's job is to find their own path in life. If they stay carefully protected in the nest of the family, children become weak and fearful or feel too comfortable to want to leave. For 20 years now, I have watched as well-meaning, dedicated parents become ever more deeply enmeshed in their children's life. No matter how busy these parents are, the child's problem remains a central preoccupation. Instead of enjoying their time with their children, they're busy fretting and fixing. The housekeeper who was required to sleep in her charge's bed was an extreme but natural extension of the sort of parental hovering that was typical of my clients. Little Kayla is overtaxed, so her mom is off to the library to do research for a Hopi Indian social studies project while Kayla's at her dance class. Zach's dad is hiring a softball tutor, so Zach will feel more secure about playing on the teams the boys form at recess. These are the same parents who refuse to let their children walk to the corner alone or don't permit their children to hand in a homework assignment without a parental edit. I'm not against helping with homework and building skills in sports, but what these parents are trying to do goes far beyond standard support and encouragement. They are trying to inoculate their children against the pain of life. There is a Hebrew phrase, tsar gidol banim, that refers to the ubiquitous pain of raising children. We parents go through years of emotional anguish as we raise our kids, but tsar gidol banim also refers to our children's pain. Wow, what a chiddush. That's a profound idea. Tsar gidol banim is not only the tsar that we feel, but she suggests it refers to the experience that the children should feel. When they are growing up, they should feel tsar. Without it, they cannot grow strong. I don't know if you ever thought about it. This is not such a chiddush, but pain is one of the greatest gifts that God has given us. We have an anesthesiologist in the room whose job it is to make people not feel pain, but he would be the first to admit that it's only for a couple of hours when we're cutting them open. But for the rest of the time, it's the greatest thing in the world. And God forbid, if it should ever happen that a person has a neuropathy and cannot feel any pain, that's the greatest sakan in the world. They don't realize when they're in danger, they're touching something hot, something sharp. So if we want our kids to be able to grow into strong human beings, they have to feel pain. They won't learn to swim. And the message communicated by all this loving parental protection is that the child doesn't have what it takes to swim alone. When Dustin's teacher won't allow him to be in the school play because of his C-graded English, and his mother promises to go talk to the principal, telling Dustin, I don't see why she's making such a big deal out of one C, she's giving him an unrealistic impression of the world. Dustin's college professors, colleagues, and employers won't be creating special rules just for him. When Ellie's parents' feelings are hurt about not getting invited to Mimi's birthday party, and her dad offers to call up Mimi's mom to try to find out why, he's teaching her that missing out on a party is a catastrophe that deserves special intervention. When we treat our children's life like we're cruise ship directors, remember that one, that's a good one, we must get them to their destination, adulthood, smoothly, without their feeling even the slightest bump or wave, we're depriving them. Those bumps are part of God's plan. So this is important when we talk about how we can know when to step in and step aside, smothering children and providing too much. We are interfering with a very, very important part of development. Tsar gidol banim. Not the tsar that we experience, but the important tsar the kids need in order to develop into responsible human beings who are going to be able to care for themselves one day. An important quote from her second book, The Blessing of a B-. How can we avoid sheltering our kids into such a dangerous state of fragility? If we want to raise young adults who know how to solve problems, we must let them have problems to solve while they are still adolescents. Yet it's harder and harder to find parents willing to expose their children to difficulty. More often, parents keep their teens busy in adult-supervised activities, so there is no time for trouble, or rush in to solve problems instead of leaving the solution in the teen's shaky hands. If mom thinks that Kayla's boyfriend isn't good enough for her, she steps in with unsolicited advice, and might even call around town to find a better one. If Jack is afraid to raise his hand in geometry class and ask the teacher to explain concepts he doesn't understand, his parents hire a friendly tutor to come over to the house after school. When Ariella has her second fender bender in the school parking lot, her parents pay for the damage to both cars and let stressed-out Ariella skip grandma's birthday party to soothe her nerves with a soak in the tub. Daniel's parents won't let him drive at night because who knows what kind of crazies might be out there. It would be cruel for parents to abandon their teens to the trials of adolescence without any protection at all. But it is also unfair to lead teens to believe that they are too weak or too delicate to learn how to sustain themselves emotionally, mediate disputes, tolerate unfamiliar situations, and negotiate bureaucracies. How to strike the right balance between appropriate guidance and restraint? The story of the Jews' trip out of slavery in Egypt offers some clues. Also, here are very interesting insights she offers. I give her credit. She's quite a machadish. The book of Exodus, the book of Shemos, which we just started, describes the quality of God's presence during the Jews' travel as a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. This beautiful image is a model for parents whose children are wandering in the wilderness of adolescence. Like God, you stand by, providing shade and light when needed, but mostly you stand back. You detach. You wait to see if your child can solve problems on his own before stepping in. You let him experience the natural consequences of his poor decisions, and you give him the freedom to make mistakes, even big ones. That's profound. I think that's a very powerful suggestion and a really, really great example. Because when you think about it, when we left Mitzrayim, we were just that. We were a fledgling nation, a young people, and God was sort of hovering over us as a concerned parent. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu models, Kavod Yochel, this parenting balance where he's there to protect, but stands at a distance and watches us fail. And we know we do in the Midbar again and again and again, but doesn't come in every single time to save the day, because that's not how you learn and become better. Now, part of the problem is that we live in a very complicated and a very scary world, which I think is part of tonight's title. Raising, stepping in, stepping outside, raising independent children in a scary world. So years ago, I heard the following. I never found this. I don't know if it's an actual study, but I heard this from my friend in a lecture I heard over 20 years ago, and I found it in one of his books. And if it's true, it's really scary. The most serious disciplinary challenges in the U.S. school system in 1940 were talking in class, chewing gum in class, running in the halls, inappropriate dress, jumping out of line, and not putting paper in the waste paper basket. That's 1940. Right, fast forward 60 years, drug abuse, lethal weapons in school, pregnancy, suicide, assault, robbery. Wow. So if that's true, and I guess it's got to be true to a certain extent. I mean, certainly we know that that list in 2000 is probably true. What was going on in 1940, I don't remember. But clearly, the world's a scary world. And, you know, it's very nice to say just sort of step back and let our kids do whatever they want. You may be thinking to yourself, if you, maybe not, but if you read the Jewish Link this past week, that some of what I said tonight seems like I'm contradicting myself. Okay, because there I wrote, you know, how dare parents go ahead and just allow their kids to do whatever they want. After all, take some responsibility for your kids. So I'm now going to quote myself and point out why I'm not really contradicting myself. That particular letter that I wrote into the Link was a response to an editorial last week where the suggestion was that if kids are, you know, abusing drugs and alcohol, then what we need to do is we need to sit down with our kids and to explain to them the dangers of drugs and alcohol, and that would be appropriate parenting. And the letter that I wrote in, which they were kind enough to print, and I only take a couple of excerpts, was that's not the whole story. It does seem to me, however, I write, that there was an important component that was absent from your editorial coverage. While parents must arm their children with the skills to protect themselves and educate their children regarding the devastating effects of alcohol abuse and drug use, the role of a parent does not end there. Quite frequently, the situations in which our teenagers find themselves in over their heads are facilitated by parents themselves, albeit unwittingly. Often, due to our passive compliance, our teenagers are found in situations where the temptations and pressures competing for their attention are simply too powerful and overwhelm their underdeveloped prefrontal cortex. At such moments, it is not necessarily education and information that our teenagers lack, nor is it a lack of motivation on their part. They simply do not possess the psychophysiological wherewithal to safely manage and navigate their situations on their own. When, if in fact we actually sit down with our children and discuss the dangers of drugs and alcohol, it is quite possible that they are listening, tuned in, and processing. But in no way whatsoever does that mean that they possess the cognitive emotional ability to make responsible choices in every setting. See, this is a big, big, big mistake. The parents assume that if we tell our kids everything they need to know, that they are automatically inoculated and they are now immune from making mistakes. But when we are allowing them to put themselves in situations where there's an incredible amount of pressure, an overwhelming amount of pressure, with very, very good that can come out of those situations, that is, in my opinion, that is parental negligence. I fully recognize that we cannot, nor should we, attempt to monitor our teenagers' every move. So here you see, I'm not contradicting myself. It is important for teenagers to develop into self-sufficient adults, which necessitates both poor decision-making and periodic failures. Such experiences are indispensable components for their healthy development and maturation. At the same time, and this was really what prompted the initial discussion, which I'm responding to, at the same time, it is nothing less than criminal for parents to allow teenagers to participate in unsupervised gatherings, events, parties, and reunions. I'm using these as examples of the types of events where parents sometimes knowingly allow their kids to attend. Again, keyword over there being unsupervised. Most of the time, not sometimes, most of the time, these events, unsupervised gatherings, events, parties, or reunions, there are different types of gatherings. Three people getting together at somebody's house is not necessarily going to turn into a big party with drinking. But it is known, and parents who are paying attention will know, that most often these events actually do develop into something which can actually be dangerous. It is not unheard of, and if, you know, forgive me if you've never heard this, but it's important that you do know that it's not unheard of at all for children from our community. I don't mean specifically our Beis HaKnesses, although we're not an exception, from our community, from every one of our yeshivas and every one of our schools, to have to attend parties, you know, with no intention of drinking whatsoever, and then having their stomach pumped several hours later. There have been situations where people have, you know, in our community have almost died. And I'm sure there are situations where they've not almost died, they have died. So turning a blind eye to a real and present danger, which they will undoubtedly encounter. It is simply unfair, and I would say cruel, for us to expect a teenager to be able to withstand the lure of a drink, a puff, or a hit when surrounded by unsupervised peers. So of course we should talk to our kids about the dangers of alcohol and drugs. And no, we should not walk around with a leash so that we're with them at every single moment. And we shouldn't tell them that you may not go out ever, and I need to know where you are at every single moment. That's not healthy, and that's not going to work. But to allow them at a time in their life when they are simply, again, I said before, they don't have the psychophysiological wherewithal. I once heard, I don't know if you ever knew this, did you ever wonder why it is that rental car companies will not rent cars before you're 25 years old? Such a random age. We could vote at 18, we could buy alcohol at 21, but we can't rent cars till 25. Anybody know why? What would you say? That's correct. That's the sign shows that it's at 25 that the prefrontal cortex is pretty much fully developed. And, you know, whenever you want to know whether something is safe, look at follow the insurance companies. They have the stats on us. They know whether something is safe or not. And they're saying a 22-year-old, even a 23-year-old, even a 24-year-old, maybe married already, two or three kids, does not necessarily have the full cognitive development to always make the right choices. So we're not saying, we're not certainly not suggesting that, you know, parents can or should forbid their kids from going to the parties when they're 24 and a half years old. Absolutely not. But when a kid is 14 or 15 or 16, they're not even close to that particular stage. And the point is, they can't. So we sit and we talk to them about how dangerous alcohol is, and they get it. They get it. But when there's a tremendous amount of pressure around them, not every kid, and you know, I don't have statistics, but I think it's fair to say that many kids do not have the ability to go ahead and to withstand that temptation. So that's where, you know, we need to, you know, find the right line that we are sort of comfortable with and we can live with. These are, well, I would say four of my favorite books. I've only read three of them, so I can't say four. But when we talk about technology in particular, and this is a really, really important conversation, which we're going to pretty much end this discussion with tonight. So it's important to become informed, not only as parents, it's just important to be informed as people as to the terrible effects that technology is having on each and every one of us. Now, as you've heard me say before when I talk about this topic, I personally don't believe that the response should be that we just completely withdraw from the world and, you know, and live in caves. You know, I don't think that that's a practical suggestion, nor do I even think that that's necessarily what, you know, the ideal approach should be. Technology is not in and of itself evil. But the dangers that exist with excessive use of technology and uncontrolled use of technology are proven and very, very concerning. So the first book and the last two over here, Irresistible by Adam Alter and Alone Together and Reclaiming Conversation by Sherry Turkle. So I've read them and I've quoted them in the past in different lectures, and I think they're really eye-opening, very good books. Somebody recently recommended this Glow Kids book to me, but I haven't read it. I'm actually going to quote from a book that somebody here gave to me the other night. I'm going to give back to her tonight. I Rules, which I'm going to quote from in a moment. But there are a lot of books, and I can't say that they're all good, but there are some very, very good books out there which help inform, again, not just parents, but just people as to what's happening to us. What is happening to us? And it's not all about, like, you know, gambling and pornography. You know, those are very, very, you know, clear and undeniable risks and dangers. But some of it is far more benign than that, at least on the surface, but very, very dangerous. Irresistible is really just about the addictive technology and the business of keeping us hooked. And it is really very scary and very, very important to learn about. There was a great article that I found online, and you could all go there. If you Google any of the words on here, you'll find it very easily. There's a great journal, which is an online journal, and some of them were printed and some were not. I'm not sure why. It's called Cloud Perspectives, and I don't think there's been one in a couple of years, but for about 3 or 4 years, they had seasonal journals which dealt with different issues in the Orthodox community. I don't know if there's a particular organization that publishes this, but put together by a very nice, they have just a nice sampling of educators and spokesmen of the Jewish community, the Orthodox community, talking about different topics. So this particular journal was devoted to the issues of technology. And Dr. Pelkovitz, who's known and a very respected leader in the Orthodox community as being an Orthodox ecologist, who's worked with many different people in the community for decades. So is this the title? I think so. Isolation versus Inoculation, Guidelines for Parents in Meeting the Challenge of Digital Technology. Now, this was written in November 2015. So you would think that it's, you know, completely obsolete at this point. You know, that's like the Dark Ages. But I think you'll find that that actually it's spot on and it's relevant. And even though the technology has really changed a lot in 3 years, and it's, you know, it's not the same world. Actually, it's only 2 years really, but still. But it's and I recommend it very much. It's a long article, but I did take just a couple of paragraphs that I wanted to share with you. Research on the psychology of change suggests two relevant components of the mindset of parents in approaching the challenges posed by digital technology. Number one, a mindset that views a task as a challenge rather than a threat results in more effective interventions, including greater persistence, more productive thoughts, and problem-solving strategies and more efficient physiological responses. Meaning, if we think that something is a threat, if we view technology as a threat, we are less likely to respond to it appropriately. If we understand that it's a challenge, and we have a little more guts and courage by looking at this challenge and try to figure out how to deal with it, we're more likely to respond appropriately. Secondly, Canadian philosopher and author Robertson Davies famously said, "The eye sees only what the mind is prepared to comprehend. When there is clarity about the nature of a challenge, effective intervention is more likely." So he's encouraging, in the opening paragraphs of this article, to look at technology, you know, dead in the eyes, and to understand what it is, and to learn about it, and to be informed, and to understand the challenge, and then we are more prepared to deal with it. He writes, in a later paragraph, "Parents, not schools or community leaders, must assume the primary responsibility for helping children manage technology use intelligently. During a recent talk that I gave at a Beis Yaakov High School, the overwhelming majority of the girls shared that they had virtually no discussions with their parents about rules and guidelines for prudent use of the internet or social media sites. Parents seem to be spending very little time discussing the more subtle issues raised by digital technology, such as the increased dangers of being cruel to others in the anonymous settings of social digital discourse, or the tendency to think and interact in more shallow and superficial ways. For parents to strongly value depth of thought and learning, as well as the primacy of proper behavior in the sphere of Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, discussions about these more subtle aspects of digital behavior are an essential component to parental responsibility." And there are many parents that are just not having these conversations with their kids, you know, either because they don't know how to, or they're not thinking about the issue, or they're just so focused on the obvious dangers with the phone and they're just trying to figure out how to filter it, that they're forgetting that all the filters in the world are not going to necessarily teach your child not to bully other people using the phone. And it's sometimes very easy to bully somebody by phone, even if you're not able to do so when you look at them in the face. "Over the last decade, studies have consistently shown that the most effective parenting style in helping children deal with digital technology is an authoritative approach. Put simply, parents must assume the role of setting firm limits regarding their child's use of technology. This does not suggest that a parent should employ an excessively strict authoritarian style that fails to pay attention to the child's point of view, but is rather an observation that a permissive parenting style is counterproductive, and parents must assume an assertive role. As Chazal tell us, the key to wise parenting is to find the balance between smol docha imin makareves, the left hand pushes away while the right hand brings closer." Now, here's this book that, again, I think, I don't know if she wants to be called out publicly, but somebody who's here, thank you so much for just the other night handing me Eye Rules, What Every Tech-Healthy Family Needs to Know About Selfies, Sexting, Game, and Growing Up. Lo Aleinu. It's an entire book, but it's important. I didn't read the book yet, but absolutely fascinating concept. And basically, the author, Janelle Burley Hoffman, and I understand that she's actually spoken at some of the local schools, and has made herself available to teachers and parents and helping. So this is not a product that I personally am familiar with enough that I said that I'm ready to sort of sell it to you. I don't know, but it's definitely something that you would want to maybe consider. And I'm speaking to the many, many people that I hope will listen to this who are not necessarily here tonight to consider the concept behind iRules, which is basically, if I understand correctly, a contract between parents and children. So I'm taking this right out of the first paragraph, and I guess we'll end with this because we're running late. But this is her opening of the book. And it's, again, you'll see it's a big book. So, dear Gregory, happy Hanukkah. You are now the proud owner of an iPhone. You are a good and responsible 13-year-old boy, and you deserve this gift. But with the acceptance of this present comes rules and regulations. Please read through the following contract. I hope that you understand. It is my job to raise you into a well-rounded, healthy young man that can function in the world and coexist with technology, not be ruled by it. Failure to comply with the following list will result in the termination of your iPhone ownership. I love you madly, and I look forward to sharing several million text messages with you in the days to come. That confused me, personally, but okay. Number one, it is my phone. I bought it. I paid for it. I am loaning it to you. Aren't I the greatest? I think that's amazing. You know, that's what I was hooked. I saw it on the back. I'm like, that's amazing. You know, sometimes, you know, we give the phone to the kids, and we're not talking, as you could tell already, we're not talking tonight about when a kid should have a phone. It's a bigger discussion. I'm not quite sure that I have the answer to it. But whenever you give a kid the phone, as long as he or she is still on your plan, I mean, you know, sometimes people never cut the cord. I mean, I have, you know, a married daughter who's still on my plan. I don't know how to deal with that yet. But what?
You do let me know.
Yeah, okay. I figured if she moved out of the country, it'd help, but doesn't seem to have helped. Okay, anyway, I'll figure it out. But the bottom line is, I bought it, I paid for it, and I'm loaning it to you. And that's okay. This is, you know, that we don't want to necessarily dare our kids to buy their own phones, because then we'll have less leverage over them. But most of them will probably not do that, because they rely on us to be able to provide them with this phone. But let's not forget that it's mine. I will always know the password. Again, we can argue. Anybody can have different arguments about some of the details over here. And of course, are we talking about a 12-year-old? Are we talking about an 18-year-old? So, there's a lot to discuss over, but just appreciate the concept behind this, not the details. If it rings, answer it. It is a phone. Say hello. Use your manners. Do not ever ignore a phone call if the screen reads mom or dad. Not ever. Hand the phone to one of your parents promptly at 7:30 p.m. every school night and every weeknight at 9 p.m. Now, obviously, 7:30 and 9 o'clock, this is not gospel, but the idea that kids, before they're 18 years old or close to it, are expected to hand in their phones at a certain point in the middle of the night, before they go to sleep at night or whatever time that's set. That's something we should all be comfortable with, and that's a right that we have to claim. It would be shut off for the night and turned on again at 7:30 a.m. If you would not make a call to someone's landline when their parents may answer first, then do not call or text. Listen to those instincts and respect other families like we would like to be respected. It does not, by the way, I don't even know that a kid would know what a landline is, but okay. It does not go to school with you. Have a conversation with the people you text in person. If it falls into the toilet, smashes on the ground, vanishes into thin air, you are responsible for the replacement cost of repairs. Mow a lawn, babysit, stash some birthday money. It will happen. You should be prepared. This goes back to what we said beforehand. You want kids to be responsible, so you can't always bail them out. You know, this is, you know, not the biggest bailout in the world. Most people have insurance on their phones, and for a regular smartphone today, usually the deductible is $200. That's the kind of money that most parents, if they really, really, really needed to, could come up with. But we shouldn't. We should make our kids come up with that money. After all, he or she lost the phone. Do not use this technology to lie, fool, or deceive another human being. Do not involve yourself in conversations that are hurtful to others. Be a good friend first, or stay the hell out of the crossfire. Do not text, email, or say anything through this device that you would not say in person. Do not text, email, or say anything to some... Oops. Oh, no. That you would not say out loud with their parents in the room. Censor yourself. No porn. Search the web for information you would openly share with me. If you have a question about anything, ask a person, preferably me or your father. Turn it off, silence it, put it away in public, especially in a restaurant, at the movies, or while speaking with another human being. I guess we could add to this, and when you're in shul, unless, of course, you've been insured, because you can't even bring it into shul. You are not a rude person. Do not allow the iPhone to change that. Do not send or receive pictures. It's so upsetting that this needs to be here, but this is the world we live in. And remember what Dr. Pelkovitz said. You know, we're more likely to be able to deal with problems if we call them challenges, not threats. Do not send or receive pictures of your private parts or anybody else's private parts. Don't laugh. Someday you will be tempted to do this despite your higher intelligence. It is risky and could ruin your teenage college adult life. It is always a bad idea. Cyberspace is vast and more powerful than you, and it is hard to make anything of this magnitude disappear, including a bad reputation. Don't take a zillion pictures and videos. There's no need to document everything. Live your experiences. They will be stored in your memory for eternity. Leave your phone here sometimes and feel safe and secure in that decision. Yeah, good luck with that. It is not alive, an extension for you. Learn to live without it. Be bigger and more powerful than FOMO, fear of missing out. Okay, she has a couple of others over here. We're going to... I like this one. You will mess up. I will take away your phone. We will sit down and talk about it. We will start over again. You and I, we are always learning. I'm on your team. We are in this together. And it's my hope, she writes to her son, Gregory, that you can agree to these terms. Most of the lessons listed here do not just apply to the iPhone, but to life. You are growing up in a fast and ever-changing world. It is exciting and enticing. Keep it simple every chance you get. Trust your powerful mind and giant heart above any machine. I love you. I hope you enjoy your awesome new iPhone. Hanukkah Sameach, Mom. And that's it. You know, I'm sure that doesn't summarize the whole book, but that's the concept over here. And the concept of a contract between parents and children when it comes to technology in particular, it's somewhat of a novel idea. I mean, I didn't grow up with a contract with my parents, but there was never, you know, I never had an iPhone either. And you know, it pays to be very, very, very clear and very concrete as to what the expectations are, because it is a very, very powerful tool and it can be a very lethal weapon. This is the last slide of the night. It comes from the very beginning of the Rambam, Hilchos Deos, Perek Aleph, Halacha Dalet, famous Rambam, but I think it really summarizes, I guess, what I would say for tonight's lecture. Haderech HaYashara, says the Rambam, the proper path in life is Midah Beinonis, is the path of taking the medium path, walking in the center. Shevachol Deo Vadeo, Mikol Adeo Sheyesh Lo Adam, all the different personality traits that we have, all the different needs that we have, all the different instincts that we have to try to find balance. We have to try to go the derech hayashar. V'hi hadeya shi rechok mishtei ha'ktzavos. This is the one that's farthest from the two extreme ends. Richuk shava ve'ena krova lo lezu v'lo lezu. Not too far to the right, not too far to the left. Lefichach, sivu chachamim arishonim, riyadam, sham deyosav tamid. A person should constantly evaluate and assess their deos, their personalities, their traits, their midos. U'misharo sam, a person should constantly evaluate where he or she is and to make sure that a person is walking straight down the middle. The way we can achieve this title, Chacham, which according to the Rambam is a great accolade, is to be a person who's balanced, to be a person, we would sometimes say a person who's normal, not to be extreme. We cannot be, we shouldn't be too prohibitive. We should not be too restrictive. We should not be too oppressive as parents. But we also cannot be too permissive. There are great, great risks always in parenting if we want to raise functioning, responsible, independent children, but especially in today's day and age where we simply cannot afford to be the kind of parents that allow our kids to, you know, to find themselves in any situation that they can imagine and deal with whatever the consequences may be. We have to be balanced. We have to find an appropriate approach down the middle. And hopefully with the help of Hashem, Bezvus Hashem, we should all be zocher to have much nachas from our children. We should hopefully have much hatzlacha in raising them. And I look forward to continuing this conversation with you in the days to come. Thank you again, and have a great night.